man with the game information. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Xbox, Nintendo, PC, or PlayStation. Game and Steve, Game and Steve. Giving the news to the nerd generation. Game and Steve. Give me news,
give me news,
give me views,
give me views.
Game and Steve.
And gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one man vortex of gaming information, the man who has a bigger sword than Cloud, ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey there, welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I'm your host, Steve Glicker, and in this week's show, I interview Jack Emmert, aka The Statesman, and creative director from Cryptic Studios, the makers of City of Heroes and the newly released City of Villains. I then answer your show mail and then have some quick final thoughts. So for those of you new to the show, welcome. This is a weekly show, or every other week, depends upon how much stuff I have going on. But I'm trying to get it back to a weekly show where we try to look at gaming from an intelligent point of view. My name's Steve Glicker. I have over 20 years game design and production experience, and I try to look at all games from a very high-level business perspective, try to give people an understanding as to why certain things are done that might not seem relevant or important to people that aren't in the industry. And something, you know, even I would say a lot of game journalists don't know about, because they really aren't people who make games or have experience making games for a living. So again, that's sort of the whole theme and concept of the show. We take a very, very deep look at games in general. And for those of you who are loyal listeners to the show, you'll probably think, what the heck's going on? Because normally my show has a lot more segments in it. Well, for this week, I actually had most of the show done, and I looked, and it was approaching 3 hours, and I said, you know what, it's time to start cutting the show in half. The show is usually pretty long to begin with. I know a lot of people really love it, nice and long, with lots of different segments, so you can listen to it over a course of a week in different pieces. I personally actually like the shows really, really long myself, but it was just getting out of hand. It's going to be like over 100 megs. And it was just too much. So I made an executive decision to start cutting the show up, at least when it starts getting this big. So this show is going to have the interview with Jack Emmert, and then I'm also going to have my show mail, and where I answer audio questions as well as letters written to me about various game topics. And then later in the week, I'm going to release the regular Gaming Steve podcast that has everything else. And in that, just to give you guys a little bit of a teaser, we have the game news of the week. I have Spore Talk, in which we'll talk about Will Wright's Spore. My game review for this week will, of course, be City of Villains, and I'm sure you all want to hear what I have to say about that. My retro review, well, I'm not going to tell you what the retro review is, but here's the preview. It's actually going to be the most disgusting, violent, and grotesque video game ever released in the history of video games. Yes, this is the retro review, and I kid you not, you'll be shocked when you hear about this thing if you never heard of it before. Name That Game, that's the segment in which I play a game sound, either from the consoles or the arcades, and you write in. If you get it right, I give you a prize, and it's still open for those of you who are interested in entering. And then I have my final thoughts. So look for that show later in the week, but right now let's get into this week's show, and I'm going to get into my interview with Jack. So early in the week, Jack Emmert and actually a lot of other people from NCSoft were here in New York City, and I got a chance to sit down and talk to Jack about the recently released City of Villains, as well as just his experience and thoughts in the video game industry and the comic book industry, what he thinks about heroes. And that interview will be coming up in a sec, but before I even get into that, I also got a great opportunity to sit down and talk to the president of ArenaNet and talk about Guild Wars for quite a while, and I was also able to talk to the president and creative team of Auto Assault. So expect to hear those interviews in the upcoming weeks. Both interviews pretty pretty interesting, I'd say, at least. The Guild Wars, we find out a lot about the future of Guild Wars, find out where the game is heading, how they really expand, how they expect to expand the game. That was an excellent interview. And Auto Assault, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, that's the futuristic car battle MMO that's coming out in a few months. I think it's coming out in February right now. It's scheduled to be released. And I saw the new updated version, which if you're playing the public beta right now, or is it public or private beta right now, it's a little rough around the edges. I will say I do enjoy the game, but obviously it's still not complete. After you see the updated version, which I got to play, wow, I have to say the graphics are up there with Guild Wars. It is really, really shaping up nicely, and I sit down and talk with those guys. And again, those are coming up in the next future episodes in the upcoming weeks. But let's get into the main event, shall we? You guys are here to listen to me and Jack talk, so let's take it away with the interview. Here I am with the Statesman's alter ego, Jack Emmert, creative director of Cryptic Studios, makers of City of Heroes and City of Villains. You look real tired, Jack.
Yep, well, you know, that's nothing like flying coast to coast and then waking up bright and early to do some press interviews. But it's, you know, obviously rewarding. City of Villains released last week, and it's been selling fantastic, and so it's all pretty edifying.
So, I mean, you have basically run the equivalent of a game marathon. You've released two MMOs in 2 years. I mean, I can't even imagine releasing one in 1 year, let alone two.
Well, I think you're the first person in America ever asked me this question. The only other time the question came up was in Europe. Mm-hmm. And a reporter asked me that, and I honestly didn't know. Like, he said, well, how can you do two when other people have trouble just doing one? Mm-hmm. And I told him that I thought it was because we were too naive, that we really didn't know any better. And I think it certainly was true with City of Heroes, and I think also with City of Villains. We were just so happy with the success of City of Heroes, and we just jumped right in to City of Villains, assuming we could conquer the world. And there are a lot of, you know, I'm not a video game expert by any stretch of the imagination, this was the first job I ever had in the video game industry, so obviously I don't know how hard things are. I learn as I go, and I think that that's actually held us in pretty good stead.
So you were able to basically do it because anyone who actually did this would have said, no, this is insane and crazy, who has actually had experience doing this. And you're like, what's the big deal?
What's the big deal, right? I just didn't even... And certainly I'm not alone. I think we all just felt through our success that we certainly could accomplish it, and obviously I'm really proud of the result and what we've done.
No, I mean, both these games, I mean, not only did you do two, but I mean, City of Heroes was obviously a big success, and was getting press out the wazoo about how well it was doing, and which probably added to its success, like, you know, after you hear about, oh, this great new MMO came out, a lot of people jumped on, and then, you know, and then every aspect of the game that people were addressing. And I remember, I mean, I was personally was sick and tired of reading, there's no capes, there's no capes, there's no capes. But immediately you guys put in capes that look not just capes, but fantastic capes. And then, okay, there's no villains. Okay, now there's villains. It's like you guys not only rise to the occasion, but you actually manage to continuously nonstop improve the game.
Yes.
At leaps and bounds.
Certainly what we try to do is hit whatever is weakest, whatever area is. And you know, that's the process for... What's coming next is already begun. You know, we've already taken a look, and we're now assessing, you know, what are the things that players want to see? What is it that we really need to do next to help increase the game experience? And with City Villains, certainly, we asked that question, PvP and being a bad guy. But the other huge criticism with City of Heroes was all you do is combat. Well, now we've introduced bases, so now you can also build. So that's another thing for you to do. And we want to keep on doing that, is addressing the weaknesses. And sometimes, certainly, players look at it at a very individual level. They don't understand why we can't get things out quicker than we do, even though, as far as I know, no MMP has ever doubled its content in a single year with free expansions, which what we did. Mm-hmm. And City Villains, of course, as far as I know, no one's ever done a game like it before. So I think we're going to keep going.
I don't even know how you guys did this. So, okay, you got City of Heroes, you got City of Villains. So what's the next year? City of Sidekicks? What
we're discussing it internally. I certainly have directions that I want to go. I'm not sure I want to do a standalone quite like this again so quickly. I would rather have a couple years to really work on one. But doing an expansion that perhaps a retail expansion that deepens the game experience in some way, shape, or form for current players, that I'm kind of interested in. But doing another standalone, I think, is a little much.
Okay. So we are here actually to talk about City of Villains. So let's get into it. So City of Villains just came out Halloween, less than a week ago. I've been playing it. I think it's fantastic. I'm a huge City of Heroes fan to begin with. So, you know, City of Villains is just more goodness, or should I say more badness, you're able to go around.
I'd say it's a lot better than City of Heroes, because in many ways it's much worse, right?
Right.
But truly, I think we took advantage of everything we learned over the past year of City of Heroes, and we put it to good use. The missions are more varied. There's more unique missions, more unique art. There are tons of new mission objectives, new mission types. There are a lot of UI tweaks and other niceties which players want, like for instance the newspaper mission. A villain can always grab a crime from the newspaper at any time, never needs to resort to street sweeping. And that's directly from players telling us what they wanted.
What about the big new class? I know there's the standard five classes, and four of them are sort of dark versions of City of Heroes, I'd say, but then you have the Mastermind class, which is obviously the one a lot of people are interested in.
Yeah, it's because it's the most obviously unique. I think the other four classes end up playing much differently, but you need to get in the teens and 20s before those differences become that apparent.
Oh, okay.
And also their inherent abilities significantly change. Well, like, for instance, one thing which people on the boards have readily realized, there is no person that manages aggro like a tanker. There's simply no equivalent.
Right.
A brute, although he does great damage and has okay resistances, has no ability to manage aggro to the level a tanker does.
Right.
And so that people found the Mastermind is a great tanker, because he sends his minions in, they absorb the Alpha Strike, and then the other teammates can come in and start attacking and start the battle. But we tried to create these. I sat down with the archetypes, and initially I was just going to come up with different names for the current archetypes. But people on the team said, well, you know, why don't you try to do something differently? So I came up with very different concepts, and I handed them over to our powers guy, Gecko. And he really did most of the work. I just did let's take the current hero archetypes and play with them. And I came up with some versions, and then he refined them to create the five, including the Mastermind, which of course is everybody's favorite at the moment because it's totally unique. There's nothing like it in City of Heroes.
So, and also in the Mastermind, even in general for pet controlling classes, I mean, you can control up to three pets.
Actually, seven pets.
Oh, really? You go up to seven? I mean, I just haven't seen anyone past three. So you have up to seven pets.
Yeah.
You can name them all.
Yep.
And you have, was it zombies, ninjas, robots?
Yep, and soldiers.
Soldiers, that's right.
And then I will tell you, thugs are next. They're almost already done, and they'll be added in so you can be like a gang leader or something.
So How do they work exactly? Just give people an idea. I mean, obviously you have sort of your, you know, you have your blaster class, you have your, which is almost like the ranged class, you have the melee
and
class.
The support.
Right.
Generally, minions are different, separated into those different categories, and then you can summon them individually, but then you upgrade them.
Oh, okay.
Mastermind has powers that enable the minions to get another attack or to have another defense or something to make them better in some way, shape, or form.
So the other big thing, obviously, is base building. I know that's not only that's a huge deal, just in general. I mean, not only for City of Villains, but just even in MMO world. I mean, you know, people are talking about player housing, and they're excited when they have player housing in game. You have like way past player housing. You have player housing and architecture and everything.
Yeah, I mean, players can create anything, just any sort of headquarters from the layout to the look to the colors. Everything is in the player's control. There's nothing like it in any MMP ever, and certainly even in PC games. I think this is a step of customizability for personal property that outside of The Sims I've really never seen. but it's also an element that that's not as it's more accessible in the mid levels from 20 level level 20 or not. So I think right now players are still kind of striving to earn enough to be able to build their own bases and be able to show them off. So I think in the next month you'll probably see a lot of stuff out there, a lot of buzz on the internet about the bases.
And how do they, since it's still so new and a lot of people haven't really been exploring it, how does it work? And can you actually go into your friend's base and sort of hang out and, you know, just sort of, you know, lounge around? Or?
Well, a player can be invited by another player into a base. So you can certainly do that and use it as a social space. A player can normally only enter their own base. They actually have to be invited otherwise, so you don't have people just wandering the halls of your headquarters.
And what about for City of Heroes? Are bases, if you have both, or is that planned? Or?
You need to buy City of Villains in order to get a base.
Right.
There's just no ands, ifs, or buts. And being that there is absolutely no increase in the subscription fee for buying both games, there's certainly no reason why not to go out and buy the software. You get four extra character slots per server, one free month of subscription, and so basically in terms of a real cost, you're looking at a $20 purchase or something.
And how else is City of Heroes enhanced when you get City of Villains?
Well, right now, bases is the primary.
Is the main big one.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's also those portals. Are those the portals to go into your base?
They certainly are.
The ones that you see in City of Heroes that mysteriously appeared last week.
Yep.
So, got it. So the main bad guy also in this one, Lord Recluse.
Yes. He is the counterpart to Statesman. His origin and background is revealed in the novel that just came out a couple of weeks ago, The Web of Arachnos, available in all your fine local bookstores. And, yeah.
And actually, so you play the Statesman.
Sure.
Who plays Lord Recluse?
Zeb Cook, who's one of our senior designers, plays the role of Lord Recluse.
So do you guys ever, like, switch off?
Do we ever switch off? Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, Statesman always supersedes Lord Recluse. But, yes. Yeah.
Are they both level 50?
Yeah, they're both level 50. They're both incarnates, which is a new... which is an epic archetype that we haven't released yet, but we will shortly.
Okay. So how does that make you feel? Like, I was thinking about that. I was, like, looking at the ads, and every ad, I mean, even look at that one, you have Lord Recluse towering over your character.
Everybody has their good days, everybody has their bad days, so, you know, you just have to take it in stride.
So what about you? What are you playing as City of Villains right now?
Right now I play Dominator. That's sort of my favorite class in City of Heroes was Controller. So in City of Villains, it's Dominator. It's my play style, I guess.
Yeah, right now, actually, I've been playing Scrapper. Scrapper's my favorite by far.
So you probably like a Brute, or maybe a Stalker.
I always play sort of a Monk type. You know, they always say that whatever you play in one MMO, you basically always play.
Sure.
You know, when EverQuest came out, I played a Monk. So I saw, Scrapper, Martial Arts, there you go. So that's what I've been playing. I love them. I think the Scrapper, actually, of all the MMOs I've played, I actually like the Scrapper. I like the boss-killing class.
Yeah.
And when you adventure, everyone's like, okay, I'll take care of these guys, you take care of those guys. Steve, go kill the purple.
Yeah,
I'm like,
sure.
Okay, no problem. You know, and I go and
that was why we gave him the criticals, right? Before we gave him the criticals. So that was part of the evolution. The great thing about an MMP is you can respond to the needs of the player. Before that, what the hell did a Scrapper do? He just did stuff. You know,
right.
He just got in there and he fought whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you focus them? How do you give a Scrapper a role? Great. You give them the highest chance of a critical against a boss.
Right.
Immediately, they're the boss killers. Boom.
Yeah. And not only that, it's also... You always need one whenever you're taking on a big, big group. So one of the things I've been hearing is that there is, and this is kind of interesting, with City of Villains, there appears to be no healing class.
Well, certainly not to the degree that there is with City of Heroes. But yeah, there's no real, there's no empathy power set. And for Corruptors, who are the equivalent to Defenders, their primary ability is ranged damage. And their secondary ability are buffing and debuffing and healing. So they're not the healers that the defenders are. They're not the protectors, as befits the nature of villains. Villains don't really help each other.
So getting on that whole villainy kick, so how does the PvP work in the release now?
Really well. you know, it, designing City Villains, we actually designed it with PvP in mind, so luckily a lot of things just mesh together quite nicely. Mm-hmm.
And there are rewards when you win?
Yeah, you gain prestige, mm-hmm. But most importantly, the context of PvP is always people are struggling for possession of something else. So mm-hmm. PvP is a means to an end, mm-hmm. not an end unto itself.
Okay. And how does the base PvP work?
If a supergroup obtains an item of power through a raid, which is a pretty cool mission against Ruler of the Ravager, they can get an item of power, put it in their base. If they do so, they then become base raid eligible. There's a period of time that a player, a base, then has to be vulnerable to a raid every day. Other groups get to, and they do this blindly, I should add, get to sign up for a base raid. So the defender knows when the attackers are coming, the attackers know when it's going on. Both sides are limited to the same amount of participants. Voila. And then it goes from there. Attackers are trying to take away the item of power. Defenders are just trying to hold on.
Can they actually damage the base at all?
Yes. Certain things can be damaged. Certain things can't. Yeah.
And the items cost influence to actually buy in the base.
They actually cost prestige, which is a new... since there was so much influence in the City of Heroes economy, it didn't make any sense to do that. Actually, though, there is some influence to prestige conversions.
So the Statesman, I mean, we were just talking a little bit about how I always liked to play like sort of a monk-like character. You know, what drew you to sort of the Statesman?
Well, he was an iconic character. He had to be the most powerful character in the universe. And so, and given his background, his mythological background, everything just sort of evolved from there, you know, being superhumanly strong and being that he has the essence of Zeus in them, that manifests itself in lightning, you know, in when Statesman is injured or mm-hmm. panicky or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And so when, I mean, you're on pretty often as a Statesman, or every so
very,
often?
Very, very rarely.
Oh, really?
Very rarely. Yeah, because I don't... It would be unfair for some people, but not other people, to see Statesmen. So it's a pretty rare occurrence.
So when you are on, though, what's your City of Heroes experience like? I mean, I imagine it's extremely different than ours.
Well, I'm on all the time, just as an anonymous player.
Right.
You know, it's obviously it's always interesting. It's always interesting to compare gameplay to, say, the forums, because, you know, pick up team. The vast majority of people never read the forums, don't know anything about what's wrong with the game. They're just in there enjoying themselves. So it's always interesting to see the strategies that other people have developed based upon their experience or their hunches or even their own myths. I mean, they just make things up about the AI that just aren't true, which always amazes me. But, you know.
So you're here in the comic book capital of the world. You're in New York City. You're from the East Coast to begin with.
Sure.
So do you still read comics?
Every week, every Wednesday. I read about 90 titles a month.
90 titles?
90 titles.
What are you enjoying right now?
I read 90 titles. you know, probably my favorite books, Justice Society, Outsiders, Teen Titans, Green Lantern, Black Panther, The Ultimates, New Avengers, Young Avengers.
So, you ever read Atari Force?
Yes, I remember Atari Force quite well, sure.
That was the prelude to City of Villains or City of Heroes? Yeah,
No. Atari, yeah, I remember Atari Force. Sure, that was great. DC, it was wonderful.
So why do you think people are so fascinated with superheroes in general?
Because, you know, it satisfies a basic human need, this idea of power, right? We all want to be more powerful than we are, and we want to be able to control the environment. So,
do you think that superheroes could exist without comic books? Because right now, you know, comic books, I mean, superheroes, with, you know, through our mythology and through, like you were saying, Zeus and gods, they always sort of existed.
Well, what would be different is they wouldn't wear costumes, right? Mm-hmm. If it weren't for color and if it weren't for comic strips, if it weren't for those things, people wouldn't really wear costumes. The Shadow, Doc Savage, they don't really wear costumes as we know it. Mm-hmm. And the idea of spandex and those things is purely a comic creation.
You know, because obviously right now the comics... They're not, I mean, they're definitely declining. I mean, they're maturing and declining, but obviously, when I was a kid, comics were huge. I mean, you talk to kids nowadays, I mean, you know, they might read them. It's obviously part of culture, but it's not nearly as big as it was 20 years ago when I was a kid.
No.
And I'm just wondering, you know, if, say, 50 years from now,
where it'll be there. It'll just morph, right, mm-hmm. like it's doing now. There'll be comic books. There'll be superheroes in movies. There'll be superheroes in video games. Mm-hmm. But the comic book medium is dying for a number of different reasons.
Right. What do you think in 50 years it's going to be like from now? I mean, do you think comic books are still going to be around? Do you think they're going to be turning into graphic novels?
They'll probably be different. The medium will be different. They'll probably exist pretty much like they have today, mm-hmm. just, you know, maybe smaller in distribution, and maybe graphic novels will be more prevalent.
Mm-hmm. So what is the future for City of Heroes? Because as you said before, and I was in the bookstore, I saw the book in the bookstore. It's describing Lord Reckless's background. You have your Hero Clicks. You have your comic books.
Role-playing game. Collectible
card game. What else? Movies?
Yeah, who knows?
Comic book, cartoons?
You know, that's... I absolutely nothing to say on that front.
Oh, okay. I mean, actually, I mean, it's amazing. This is probably one of the very first... I mean, there's been a lot of video games that have sort of turned into popular culture, but this is almost a video game based on a pop culture turned back into...
Yeah, it's kind of
pop
weird.
Culture.
We're not Sonic the Hedgehog, right?
Right.
We're just sort of trailblazers. We're kind of a mirror that reflects a popular genre already within society. So that's kind of unique.
So MMOs. So you have now two games under your belt, two MMOs
yep.
or MMPs. So another one, or do you think you're just...
Who knows, maybe.
You don't know? I mean, you guys seem to be awfully good at doing them.
Well, you know, wouldn't surprise you.
So, all right, so a couple of general questions.
Sure.
Marvel or DC?
DC, certainly, because they're not suing me.
Oh, that's right. Favorite artist? Comic book.
Ooh. Probably Pacheco, Carlos Pacheco.
Mm-hmm. Favorite author?
Geoff Johns.
Favorite comic book of all time?
Favorite comic book of all time, New Teen Titans.
Really? New Teen Titans?
Sure, New Teen Titans. Mm.
Favorite superhero?
Nightwing.
I've heard this before. And what about Prince Namor?
He's another favorite. If Marvel wasn't so.
Oh, okay. All right, so here we go. We have the Mexican standoff. We have Prince Namor. We got Nightwing. And we got the Statesman.
Yeah.
Who wins?
Well, it's clearly Statesman will win, but clearly right now. But, you know, I mean, Namor would be in his strength class, but you can never put down a protege of Batman because you don't know what he's going to do. But I'd like to think Statesman there is going to prevail.
Okay. So what about the same thing, Prince Namor, Nightwing, and Lord Reckless?
Oh, well, yeah, I think Lord Reckless, certainly. But because if Lord Reckless is the match for Statesman, then, yeah, certainly. Namor and Nightwing won't be able to compete.
So, all right. Well, thanks a lot, Jack.
Sure.
I really appreciated the interview.
No problem.
So definitely check out City of Villains. It's available now. And thanks again.
Great. Thanks for coming out.
Once again, thank you so much, Jack, for sitting down and talking to me about your new City of Villains. It was a real pleasure to meet you. And for those of you interested, definitely check back next week or later in the week when I release my review of City of Villains for the PC and what I think of it. And with that, let's get into the show mail segment. So here's the show mail segment is where you guys can send me your questions and I'll try to answer them. I can't answer them all. I will just let you know right now. I will try. If I don't answer it on the show, I'll definitely send you an email or answer it in forums or something just because it is getting actually a little crazy. I was getting so many questions that it's getting a little nuts. So anyhow, let's listen to the first question, shall we?
Steve, this is Devin hailing from Tucson, Arizona. I love the show. It's great to listen to in the car, and it sure beats the heck out of radio, so I guess thanks for making a living this way. On to my question. I have a business morals ethics question for you. Every year, around the month of October, Toys R Us promotes a buy two, get one free game deal. And as it seems, people like to take advantage of this offer, save up quite a bit of money, and then go buy four games and get two free, so on and so forth. They then return these games to stores with liberal return policies, such as CompUSA or Walmart. Walmart actually only allows you to return things without a receipt 3 times a year, and they also have a limit as to the amount of store credit they can give you at any one time. So, I was looking for your insight on that issue, how it affects all parties involved, and yeah. On a related note, it's no big secret that after Christmas, during the return frenzy, most customer service managers instruct their employees that it doesn't matter if it was bought at that store, it doesn't matter if they have a receipt or not, but so long as they carry the specific product, they can take it back in return for store credit. So, hope to hear back on that. Thanks.
So, thanks a lot, Devin. That was a very good question. I have to first say that I actually do not do this for a living. I wish I did this for a living. I mean, I make games for a living, but this podcast and the site I just sort of do for fun. You know, I figured I've been doing this so long, and I go to so many shows, and I know so many people, and at the time, podcasting was just starting when I started this, if you remember back in March, and I figured, what the heck, it would be fun. I actually really started in February. I just didn't really launch until March. And obviously, it's gotten pretty big since then. Anyhow, your question. This actually reminds me of the movie Garden State. For those of you who saw it, there's a guy who goes into a store, picks something off the shelf. This is actually Peter Skarsgård who plays his character. He actually picks something off the shelf, goes right up to the front, and then returns the item he picked up off the shelf for our money. And he was explaining in the movie how that there's a hole in their system. You're allowed to return like one thing, you know, for under $40 without a receipt. And he was just taking advantage of the system. So with this, again, first you asked if it was morally wrong. And in my opinion, yeah. But, you know, who am I? I mean, I'm Steve. I think, you know, that that's the wrong thing to do. You obviously don't want to go to Toys R Us and, in essence, get free software and then go somewhere else and return it and get money. But I do have to say, if there's anyone who knows how to rules lawyer better than anyone else in this world, and that's gamers. And those of you who are rules lawyers, you know what that is that you basically look at the rules and you study them to death until you find every single little hole possible. And there's a very good rules lawyering hole right there, is that buy two, get one free from Toys R Us, take that free game, go somewhere else and return it. Now, the thing to keep in mind is that this has been going on for a long time, and right now, you can only return things to most stores without a receipt for store credit. They won't actually give you your money back. And, you know, back when I was a kid in the 80s, I mean, you know, people used to do very similar things, and they used to return stuff, and you'd get cash back, which I think is, you know, obviously a lot worse, at least for the stores. And I was actually talking to my wife about this, and she said that every industry has this problem. She told me that when she with Bloomingdale's, that this was, they were infamous for this, is that Bloomingdale's would allow you to return anything, and people would always return shoes and clothes and handbags and you name it. Whatever you got, didn't matter where it was from, you'd go to Bloomingdale's, return it, you get your cash back. And they were getting killed by this. So what do? They changed their policy. And, you know, that's what's kind of going on right now. But it is interesting because you have some people like Circuit City who had a return policy in which you would actually have to pay the restocking fee, which is 15% of the actual cost of the item. And they were just getting blasted left and right every year. I remember reading about them every year. Everyone went nuts saying it's ridiculous how they have this restocking fee. I remember politicians were going after them and states, you know, saying, you know, I mean, I guess I don't know exactly the laws on returns, how it works, but they were really getting a lot of negative press on this, and they actually changed that policy. But long story short is that, you know, it's, you know, the stores, they actually, they make out fine in this, is that if they get, you know, let's say, I'm just going to use an example, Grand Theft Auto. They get a free version of Grand Theft Auto from Toys R Us. That person then goes to the Best Buy and returns and say it was a gift, unopened, you know, Grand Theft Auto. They then get credit for their, you know, for their returned game for Best Buy. That game then goes back on the shelf, or if it's, you know, defective or manufacturer problem, it'll go back to the publisher and then go to a liquidator who will sell it for dirt cheap. And then Best Buy has someone who has, you know, they don't really lose any money right off the top of the bat because they actually got a game for it. It's almost like a trade-in for them. And then the other thing is that they have a gift certificate. So that person is going to come back to Best Buy and have to spend that gift certificate, and they'll probably buy more than what the gift certificate is worth. So, you know, and this is a pretty good deal, especially if it's someone who maybe not would normally go to Best Buy. A good example is like my father. He likes to shop for electronics online. He doesn't really, you know, go out to Best Buy, places like that. But I gave him a gift certificate, and of course he went to Best Buy to spend, you know, the gift certificate, and of course he spent more than the gift certificate was worth. So I don't think the retailers are crying about this. I really don't think they care that much. And Toys R Us doesn't care because they get to sell unwanted inventory. They get to clear off their shelves, so they don't care. You have the other retailers that give out store credit, so they don't care. The only people that probably really get hurt are the stores that give out cash, which I don't can't think of too many that do that anymore. And indirectly, you know, the publisher gets hurt. But, you know, and this is really, you know, this I don't think there's any way really around this. And one thing is, you know, in fact, let's take it one step further. Imagine you take that game and you go to GameStop or EB, and then you could bring it back and say it's used. And once again, they actually do give you cash, but they give you a much smaller amount of cash. You know, how it works is that they give you credit, which is worth a lot more, or they'll give you cash back. But the cash could literally just be $5, and that's it. So thanks for the question, Devin. I hope I answered it somewhere in there. And let's get to the next question.
Hey, Steve. This is Tristan from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I love your show very, very much. It's probably the best podcast I listen to. It's very well done. And I just wanted to ask you a question. With the Xbox 360 being able to stream live in regular high-def TV signals from a media center PC, I was wondering, why couldn't they have just fully integrated into the system itself? And do you think with like the release of a higher capacity hard drives coming out sometime next year in the near future, do you think it'll be possible that we'll be seeing those hard drives coming with Media Center pre-installed onto them? And like maybe releasing a USB tuner to plug in to the USB port to make it a fully integrated digital video recorder? I mean, I'm sure the Xbox 360 is powerful and capable enough to do this, but at the same time, do you think if they did do that, it would lose less of its name of being more of a game machine or kind of like a media center, you know what I mean? Also, I was wondering if you think the Xbox 360, if it was to lean that way, do you think it could come like a first step towards movies and games on demand? And that's all. Keep up the good work, and don't stop making podcasts. Thanks very much. Bye.
So thanks, Tristan. That actually is a very interesting question. So you're basically asking, why didn't Microsoft just release the Windows Media Center inside the Xbox 360? And this actually is an interesting question. Okay, the Windows Media Center, for those who don't know, it's basically sort of a optimal version of Windows, or not optimal, it's an optimized version of Windows made specifically to record programs, and you can see movies, it works kind of like TiVo, you can see your photos, things like that. It's basically like TiVo Plus, and this runs on your standard computer. The thing with the Windows Media Center is that it's pretty complex and requires a lot of the core Windows code, from what I know. So for them to actually rip that apart and actually put it into something like the Xbox 360, I think would require not only a huge amount of hard drive space, but a fair amount of processing power, which I think the Xbox 360 can handle, but also just a large amount of code and programming. But that's actually not the main reason why they kept it, I think, as a separate entity. The main reason is that the Windows Media Center is updated and they release a new version every single year. Now, I don't know if you know that, but they constantly are updating the Windows Media Center. It's one of the few things that they do update this frequently. If you know Microsoft, is that they update, they update Office every year, but, you know, something this complex, it's almost like a Windows operating system in a way. They don't update Windows every single year. You know, they update it every 5 years or so. It's almost like a new console release at this rate. So for them to actually update this software every single year, here and then put it inside the Xbox 360, it would be a big problem. Because, you know, one of the reasons they update it every year is that there are always new technologies. You know, right now, if, you know, if Tebow's for a few, from a few years ago, if you have an HD TV, it won't work. That's just happened to me. I mean, I got HD all over the place, and my TiVo basically isn't doing anything because I can't get the signal. So I had to get the one that's offered by Cablevision that actually has built-in HDTV DVR recording capabilities. So they always have to keep these up to date. The Windows Media Center always has to be available to use the latest and greatest technology. So if they integrated that onto the Xbox 360, you know, say 1, 2, 3, 4 years down the line, not only is it outdated, but it becomes a total nightmare to keep them updated to, you know, constantly release patches to it. You get people who are angry, who don't understand why this technology isn't the latest and greatest. And then also, it's not that easy for Microsoft to just, you know, release, say, a version 1 of Xbox 360, then every year release a new version, then update the hardware, update the software on the actual hard drive. So It just would have been an absolute nightmare for Microsoft to keep up with this. So, you know, they already have the product. It already works pretty well on Windows operating systems. It already has an install base. Not a huge one, but it has one. So, if anything, they can think of it as a reverse Trojan horse. They being Microsoft, so they take the Xbox 360 and people say, hey, what's this Windows Media Center? Which I bet you a lot of you guys are thinking while I'm talking about this right now, saying, what is this thing? I'm going to go check it out. And it sounds pretty cool. And there you go. And now people are going to look at it and maybe install it on their computer. I didn't actually cover the Windows Media Center, by the way, in all my previous Xbox 360 coverage and the roundtable we had a few weeks ago on the show. Even though I saw it and played around with it, it actually was really nice, I do have to say. I mean, it's almost not even being talked about by anybody, but it really was quite impressive. And it was completely streamless. It looked great. It really had a lot of options. And I'm actually going to seriously consider installing it myself because I have every single picture I've ever taken on my computer already. I have a huge hard drive on my computer. I actually have a terabyte worth of hard drive space on my computer. So, you know, it's really a no-brainer for me to get this thing, install it, and this way I can stream everything, you know, right onto my big screen TV. I have a huge screen TV. So I'm definitely going to check it out. But there's the long, short answer of it, Tristan, why it wasn't installed directly in the Xbox 360. Thanks a lot for your email.
Hey, Steve. This is Greg from Maine. And my question concerns some comments you made about Civilization 4 last week in your review. How you said that all the good, bad things had been taken out of the game and that it was maybe a little less compelling as a result. And I'm curious to know if you think that this is a trend that will continue with developers, if they might be less inclined to take risks and be experimental, especially considering how much games cost to make and how much effort and complexity goes into making them. Or will there always be kind of niche for games that, you know, push the envelope a little bit. And that's it. Thanks.
So, Greg from Maine, thanks for your question. So, are developers less inclined to do risks and Civ 4? So, those of you who didn't listen to my review of Civ 4 last week, I basically said one of the main reasons I didn't enjoy the game as much as previous games is that they removed a lot of negative gameplay elements. For instance, pollution was removed from the game for those who haven't been playing Civ 4. And by removing all of the negative aspects of the game, they leave nothing but good aspects, and that makes a boring game. If you don't have highs and lows, all you have is highs, and all the highs become the same. So that's one of the issues I was saying with that. So talking about Civilization specifically, I just wanted to clarify that because my friends and I were talking about this quite a bit. We've been playing it the last week and just getting an idea of you know getting deeper into the Civ programming and the gameplay. And you know, it's weird. I think the game would have actually been a better game if they just kept in a little bit more negative aspects. But you know, that was a design element. If you read the very interesting entry by the dev team in the instruction manual, know, they explained why they did it. You know, they wanted the game to be nothing but fun. They really wanted to make it the most fun Civilization of them all. So they saw what people didn't like about the game, what they thought was extra, or they thought people really dreaded. And one of the things that people just hated in the game was pollution. But, you know, that doesn't mean you take it out. If people hate it, that just means it's a good incentive for them not to do something that causes that, like start nuclear wars. So anyhow, let's get back to the other one. Are developers less inclined to do risks? Yeah. Okay. Next question. No, I'm kidding. So, yeah, no, they are. Of course they're less inclined to do risks, and I'll tell you why. One very simple reason is risks do not equal sales. I'll give you a perfect example. Let's look at two big risks that were just taken recently. Gun by Neversoft. That was a pretty big risk. Here's a game that was, you know, it's set in the Wild West. There haven't been too many of those. And, you know, the game is doing okay. I don't think it's taking off, doing amazing. And you have something else. You have The Warriors by Rockstar. This is a beat-em-up game, 3D beat-em-up game. I can't even remember the last time I saw one of these, based on a movie from the 70s. Once again, it's doing okay. I mean, you know, it's not doing amazing. But, you know, these are risky games, and they're just not doing absolutely fantastic because risk doesn't equal sales. And what does equal sales, unfortunately, is brand loyalty and brand recognition. You know, good gameplay, innovative gameplay, risky gameplay does not equal sales. I mean, I can think of off the top of my head 100 games that were absolutely fantastic that no one bought because no one saw them. And you know why? It's because brand loyalty works. I mean, there's a reason why EA releases one sequel after another after another. And they release, you know, Lord of the Rings games, and they release James Bond's games, and et cetera, et cetera. And now we sit here and we complain. I was listening to some other podcasts, and they were going on and saying, oh, I can't believe this. We're getting the same crap from EA time and time and time again. Well, you know what? EA is laughing all the way to the bank. They hear you. They hear the fanboys, but they don't care because the fanboys are a very small population. You know who's the bigger population? Everyone else. And I'll give you an example. If you go into a store and if you see, you know, I don't know, we'll say Madden 2006, you might think, oh, great, just another game. Or, you know, but you see DOA 4, you think to yourself, oh, you know, great, I've been looking forward to that. Or you see Soul Calibur 3, you think to yourself, okay. Now, those games are just, you know, rehashes of old styles. But now you have a game like, I don't know, Batman Returns or Spider-Man, and you think, oh, crap, I'm not going to buy that. I mean, it's probably total junk. But then you have a mom or a grandmother goes into the store, and she doesn't know what the heck, you know, Tekken is. She doesn't know what the heck Soul Calibur is. She doesn't know what Dead or Alive is. I mean, those games mean nothing to her. She's going to see, and maybe those have amazing, innovative gameplay, and or we even take that one step further. She doesn't know what Gun is. She's not going to buy a game called Gun for her kid, or she's not going to buy The Warriors or things like that. But you know what? She sees Spider-Man, and she thinks, you know what? Little Timmy likes Spider-Man, and Spider-Man is a good movie, and it's a good comic book, and everyone seems to love Spider-Man, so the game must be good. Voila. Or, hey, you know, the Batman movie was great. I know little Timmy loved it. I'll buy him the Batman game. That must be good, too. Voila. You know, that's why it happens. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, there's a reason why there's all those games in the stores, and they continuously come out, and also for Game Boy. I mean, I don't know if you've ever sat down. Take a look at the Game Boy Advance release list, and there's games you cannot believe. I mean, I don't know if you like The Incredibles. They just released a new game a couple of weeks ago for the DS, and I'm sure you never saw a single review of this game. I'm sure almost no one's even heard about this game. And I'm also sure that this game is actually probably selling pretty well because a lot of little kids have DSs. A lot of little kids are walking around playing them all the time. Mommy and daddy want to keep, you know, the kids happy and quiet. I know, since I am a parent. And if you see something that the kids like, they see The Incredibles. You know what? Maybe The Incredibles doesn't have the most innovative gameplay. Maybe it's not the new Nintendogs. But so what? It's going to sell. Anyhow, to get back to another reason why they don't innovate, or you know, they're not going to take these innovations, is it costs money. The only way they're going to innovate is if someone else's neck is on the line. It's kind of like Hollywood. For instance, if Steven Spielberg had just signed that huge contract with EA, says, I want to make a game about walking and talking umbrellas, EA will say, cool, man. You know, they'll do it. As long as you have your name on the box and it says Steven Spielberg's talking umbrellas, we're all for it. And this way, if it fails, you know, the heads at EA can say, hey, look, it's Steven Spielberg. What do you want, man? This is an icon. This is a legend. Or if you're someone like, oh, I don't know, Will Wright, and you want to release something like The Sims or Spore. Another way you can do it is if you actually design and make the entire game yourself and go to the publisher. In fact, I guarantee if you want to sell a game, make a game, make a finished game. I know this sounds insane, but this actually happens. Go to a publisher and say, here's my game. Would you like to distribute it? And movies do this all the time. This is unbelievably common in the movie industry. People will go, they'll make a movie, they'll finish the movie, then they go to like Sundance. That's what these are for, these festivals. They go to Sundance, you can see the movies, and then they will, you know, Fox or Universal or something will actually say, oh, you know what? I will pay you, you know, whatever, $7 million for the rights to distribute that movie. And that's it. And, you know, the movie was actually made by someone else, and they hope to recoup their money on the initial sale of the movie and then the movie itself after it gets released. Same thing. If you know Roller Coaster Tycoon, that actually was financed by one person, by the guy who made the game. What was his name? Chris Taylor? Was that his name? I can't remember his name off the top of my head, even though I love that game. But I'm sure everyone's screaming it into the computer right now. But anyhow, Chris actually pretty much designed, wrote, and finished that game all by himself. He went to Atari, I believe, who publishes it now, yeah, and said, here you go, you know, here's a game. Atari, they were gonna publish it. They didn't really have anything behind it. They really didn't promote it that much. I actually remember before this was going to come out, I think I was at GDC or E3 and was talking about this with some people, and they were saying how, you know, they really weren't pushing this game and they didn't expect anything of it. And then when it came out, well, the rest is history. I mean, it was a monster, huge hit. It started the entire Tycoon franchise, you know, and all the ripoffs of all the Tycoon games. And this guy, you know, he had the risk. He's the one who believed in his product so much. And all Atari had to do was pony up the marketing budget and actually build the game and send it out themselves. So that's how risks get made, when you have really big names against these games, or you have someone who's willing to take the risk for you and the amount of risk they have is minimal. Or the other place you're going to see risks, you're going to see risks on Xbox Live Arcade for the 360. I guarantee that's where you're going to see risks, because those games are very small. They're going to be made by, you know, developers and publishers. They're not going to cost a lot. They don't have to worry about the delivery mechanism. They don't have boxes or anything. So that's where you're going to see risks. But the most important thing to remember of all that, then I'll wrap this up, is risks do not make better games and do not guarantee sales. Brand recognition and brand loyalty guarantee game sales. If you're very lucky, you might have the next Grand Theft Auto, in which it is, you know, gameplay is so good, it actually becomes a cultural icon and transcends everything, transcends video games and becomes part of culture itself. But, you know, I can't think of too many other games that do that. Grand Theft Auto is probably the last one. And even if you say, well, what about Halo 2? Well, yes, Halo 2 did that, but Halo had a hell of a lot of help from Microsoft and them pushing the game for millions and millions and millions of dollars. So don't think that just happened overnight on a grassroots campaign. Anyhow, thanks for your question. So I have a couple of written questions, but the questions are getting kind of long, so I'm not sure if I want to get them all right now. But let's see, what do I have here? Okay, I'm going to go through these real quick. I have one. Dear Steve, almost all my friends pirate their games. The software, I try to tell them it's wrong and it hurts the game industry in the end, but they don't seem to care. They spout things like they're so overpriced. It costs 50 cents to make the CD and put the info on it, but they sell it for $50, and they never buy the game and software to begin with, so they're not losing any money anyhow. Can't seem to reason with them. Game Steve, how do I help my friends from pirating games and software? Flay them. So I actually wrote back to him and I asked him how old these guys were, and he said they were 15, 16 years old. Well, first of all, I know a lot of people when they're about that age is that they'll just do it to do it. And it sounds weird, but pirating software is considered geeky and cool. You know, it's the, I guess, the equivalent of being in a gang for geeks. It's like, ooh, I have pirated software. The other thing is a lot of people have pirated software just to do it. Doesn't mean they even do anything with it. I mean, I know people who have, when I was that age and growing up and people used to pirate software all the time, they would have hundreds and hundreds of pirated discs, and they were cool because they had more than anyone else. And be like, oh no, I have 1,000 pirated games. Oh no, well, I have 2,000 pirated games. Ooh, he's cooler. You know, so it's not that they're pirating games necessarily to actually pirate them and play them. They were pirating maybe them for other reasons. Something else to keep in mind is that, you know, I believe it's a phase. If you don't want to pirate games, then don't pirate them. I mean, I have friends of mine who never ever pirate software, who refuse to ever pirate software their entire lives, and they buy everything, and there's nothing wrong with that. So, you know, just don't take part of it. The other thing to keep in mind is that I want you to take a look, everyone who's listening, take a look at your DVD shelf, and I want you to look at that and tell me how many of those DVDs that you have never ever opened. Okay, then how many of those DVDs you've seen maybe once? And then how many of those DVDs you actually regularly see over and over again. Now, I would say unless you have small children that want to see The Incredibles for the 595th time, you probably have not seen those DVDs more than once or twice. And probably a large number of those DVDs are just sitting on the shelf collecting dust. And the reason for that is that people like to be connected with things they love. What that means is that, you know, a big reason that DVD sales do so well is that people, for instance, will take Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings comes out and people love the movie and they want to feel part of it. And trust me, the marketers know this. They're not idiots. They do everything in the power to give you this feeling of belonging and acceptance and to be part of the experience. You know, it's like, oh, Lord of the Rings, I love this movie. I want to show the world that I love this movie. I want to be part of this movie. So I'm going to buy this special edition. I'm going to proudly put it on my shelf. Yeah, maybe I'll never watch it, but I'm declaring to the world it's my badge of honor. And there we go. Same thing, you know, with video games is that not as much, but I do know people who have downloaded games, played them, enjoyed the game so much that they actually went out and then bought it because they, you know, they wanted to be part of it. They also maybe wanted to get the manual, or they wanted to get a cool map that was in the game, or they actually wanted to, you know, feel more connected to the game, or maybe they were wondering if something was left out because it was a pirated version. So, you know, that is actually a very interesting cultural phenomenon, and it's actually almost a human phenomenon, is that, you know, to feel connected with something, you actually have to own it. So, you know, this is a phase that people, you know, I say all guys go through this. I don't know. Actually, it's not true. I knew one or two people who had never, ever pirated software in their lives. And especially nowadays, it's just so easy. I'm not saying it's right by any way, shape, or form, but it's hard. I mean, it's hard when you have access to the software. But at the same time, it's just such a pain in the neck. I mean, I never do it. It's just such a pain in the neck to download it. It takes a very long time, even with a high-speed connection for BitTorrent usually. And then it doesn't always work, and you have to figure out how to configure the CDs and blah, blah, blah. Before you know it, you know what? I just go down the street, buy the damn thing for $10, and there we go. Now I could actually own it and watch it, because the hours it's going to spend for me to set this thing up is not worth $10 of my time. So don't worry about it. Don't worry about a flam. I'd say just, you know, go with the flow. And in a few years, you and your friends will have money. And then instead of pirating stuff, you'll just buy it instead, just like the rest of us loyal consumers. All right. I'm going to only take one more question. And, oh, boy, these are pretty good. Let's see. Hey, Steve. Don't you think Nintendo changed the release date of the new Zelda to expand the lifetime of the GameCube? If they release it now, there'd be a huge time between two large Nintendo titles. And signed by Wanter. So, Wanter, yes, you're right. They did. Okay, next question. All right, no, I'm kidding. So, real quick, Yeah, they did. I think that's one of the main reasons. They did it for a couple of reasons. One reason is that they didn't want to compete against Xbox 360. You know, there was just going to be so much press around that. And the Zelda, they really tried to always make Zelda a big cultural event. The other thing was something that big. It's almost like Blizzard does the same thing. They don't care. I mean, sure, sales will probably be maybe in theory better around Christmas time. But when the title is that big, it doesn't really matter. It's probably still going to sell extremely well. And especially if you have already, you know, I'd say the GameCube is already almost a niche market to begin with, especially at the end of this life cycle. It's not like people are going to wake up and say, oh, the new Zelda game is out. I'm going to go out and buy a GameCube right now so I can play the new Zelda game. There will probably be a couple of people, but for the most part, it's already their pre-installed base. Those are the people that are going to go out and buy the new Zelda game. So, yeah, it stinks that you have to wait for it, but if it comes out in February or March or April, you're still going to buy it, okay? And I'm going to buy it, you're going to buy it, everyone who loves Zelda is going to buy it. So, you know, I think they're just trying to release it when it's a little bit quieter and when they can maximize their sales. And also, yeah, they want to, you know, make sure that the GameCube has as long life cycle as possible. And one of the best ways to do that is to go out with a bang, to release one of your best games and your strongest franchise at the very end of the life cycle. And it's definitely going to keep, you know, people from taking their GameCube and throwing it in the closet and throwing it away when they get the Xbox 360, because they know that that Zelda game's coming out. And another thing that's kind of interesting is that this actually is a little different, but the game release schedule is very different in Japan. Not that it's actually going to be released. They sometimes release these games totally different times. But in Japan, unlike the States, where Christmas is really the big time of year, in Japan, the big time of year to play video games is, believe it or not, the summer, which is completely the opposite for America. The reason is that in Japan, they have these tests that all the kids have to take, these national tests that make the SATs look like a pop quiz. And throughout the year, these kids are just studying their brains out to take these tests. And the only time of the year in which they really get a break and they don't have to study is during the summer. So, believe it or not, their schedule in Japan is completely reversed. Is the big time is to release games in the summer, not in Christmas. I mean, they still, you know, they celebrate Christmas in Japan, that, you know, and it's a big holiday, but it's nothing compared to the UK and the US. I mean, it's, you know, the UK and US dwarf what Christmas is like in pretty much all other countries. Anyhow, so that's something else. If they release the game in the spring or near the summer, they will probably maximize sales not only in the United States but also in Japan, where Legend of Zelda is a huge deal as well. So that's one of the reasons why it's getting pushed back. But don't worry, you know, the game looks fantastic. For, you know, it definitely looks cool, I can tell you that much. I mean, it looks amazing. And then, you know, it's going to come out. So as they say, actually, I'll tell you my favorite quote by Oscar Wilde, is that there's only two tragedies in life. One is not getting what one wants, and the other is getting it. And I say that all the time. It's like, I sit here, and I've talked about this in other shows, and you sit here, and it stinks, and you can't wait for the new Zelda game comes out. Then the Zelda game comes out, and you're upset because you have the Zelda game. And it's true. It's almost more fun. The waiting is almost more fun. I have to tell you how many times I've been waiting for these games to come out, and I can't wait, I can't wait, I can't wait, and they come out, and I buy the game. And then it sits on my shelf for a month, and I don't even play it after waiting for it for months and months of anticipation. So enjoy the anticipation. It's actually fun. And thanks a lot, Wanter. And, oh, you know what? I'm going to do one more question. All right, this is it. This is way too long, but I'm going to do one more question because I know you guys like these. Real quick, Danger Boy writes me, I was wondering if you'd be able to get to my question about Sega and Nintendo, why they seem not to hook up fans in Sega direction, at least a failure, the damaging of the image instead. Also, you mentioned there's a reason that science fiction MMOs, RPGs, don't work as opposed to fantasy. Could you explain that? Okay, I'm going to go through both these quick. So the first question is why don't... He goes into some... he actually has a longer email, explains... Why don't they make sequels to, like, the Zelda games, for instance, the Zelda games from the N64? Why did they come out with a cel-shaded Zelda game, say that five times fast, instead of coming out with, say, a Zelda 3 game, you know, sequel to the, was it Arcada of Time, I believe this is the last Nintendo game. The main reason is because they don't like to do that, because if you jump from one game system to another, you don't want to have sequels jumping systems. So, for instance, you don't want to have Zelda Part 1 and Part 2 be on the N64 and then Zelda Part 3 to be on the GameCube. The main reason is that people will feel left out. People who are new to the Zelda genre, people are new to the GameCube, they're not going to necessarily want to pick up Zelda 3, knowing it's a continuous storyline, and they're definitely not going to go out and buy old technology. So usually, you'll see this always happen. Whenever a new game station comes out, a new technology, the actual new games in those series, they're not true sequels. They will make them similar, and they'll, you know, and but they're sort of side stories, and they do this all the time, which will be interesting to see what they do with Halo 3. I say they do something similar. Well, who knows, but from what, if any other company was doing this, they would probably make Halo 3 pretty different from Halo 1 and 2. It obviously would take place in the same universe, but they would really make it different, not only to take advantage of the 360 architecture, but to make people feel that they can actually buy Halo 3 and not necessarily experience Halo 1 and 2. So that's one of the reasons why they don't do true sequels. And the other reason is also, quite frankly, selfishness of the part of the game developers. How dare they? You know, game developers get bored, okay? If I told you how many people are bored, the guys who are working on EverQuest, I know guys there, they're bored out of their mind. I mean, they just keep doing the same thing every day, day after day, for years and years. Trust me, these guys do not enjoy that. So, yeah, it's great to work on a new project. Same thing. You know, working with the same engine, they, you know, using the N64 Zelda engine two times in a row, you know, do you want to do it another time? No, they wanted to go in another direction and do something cool. So that's one of the reasons they do that. So, and real quick, let's see. Why no science fiction MMOs don't work as opposed to fantasy? Oh boy, that actually might be a good topic for a game talk, because that I can spend an hour going into. For those of you who don't know, last week I was saying how science fiction MMOs have basically failed, every single one. Even Star Wars Galaxy has failed. Yet every single fantasy MMO succeeds. They don't all succeed, but they do succeed in the sense that even the crappiest ones could easily sell a million copies, no problem. But no science fiction MMO really does that great. I saw a talk on this at GDC, Game Developers Conference, and I went through some of my notes, but there's a lot of reasons for this. One of the main reasons, and again, I can do a whole game talk on this, but I'm going to go through it, is that one of the main reasons is that with an MMO, you want to have people that already kind of know. There's a lot you have to invest into this MMO. Now, with fantasy, there's a lot of archetypes and information that people already know, believe it or not. I mean, think about it. You know what an elf is. You know what a dwarf is, or a troll, or an orc, and things like that. So immediately, you can go into any fantasy world, you already know that, okay, there's swords, and there's magic, and there's thieves, and, you know, there's fighters, and, you know, these are all the type of archetypes you expect to see in the game. And you think, okay, dwarves are going to be short and stocky, and elves are going to be tall and thin, and you already have all these preconceptions. Now, this sounds like, oh, what's the big deal? Well, that's a big deal, because people, it's almost like a brand. People will be able to go in and pick up the game that much faster. They'll be able to go in, they'll feel comfortable with the game, they already know what to expect. You can jump into EverQuest 2 right away without knowing anything, and you already know how more or less the game world works. Well, you take a science fiction MMO, not the same thing. I mean, think about it. You have humans, okay, and then what? You have aliens, okay. What type of aliens? There are no aliens. There's no standard aliens out there. And the, quote, standard aliens are all protected by copyright. It's not like you can use Star Trek aliens, because those are Star Trek aliens. You can't use Star Wars aliens, because those are Star Wars aliens. So you have to invent your own aliens. Elves and dwarves are public use. Anyone could use a dwarf. Anyone. Anywhere. So what are you going to do? Well, science fiction, we're going to put up these really cool creatures. We're going to put up the Zorlocks and the Rickrocks and the Grimlocks. okay, what the heck are those? See, already it's like you have to really invest a lot of time and effort. You have to learn the system. You have to understand it. And, yeah, that's cool from the developer's point of view because they get to build the entire world from scratch. But for a gamer, it requires a huge amount of commitment up front and a huge amount of time to, like, really invest themselves into the game. So that's one huge – and that's what's called a barrier to entry. That's a massive barrier of entry into a science fiction MMO. Another reason science fiction MMOs don't do as well is the actual landscape itself. I'll give you an example. If you are playing, I'd say, City of Heroes, which takes place in an urban landscape, you know immediately what to expect. You see buildings, you expect buildings. You see lakes and rivers and ships, you know exactly what's going on. You see an industrial complex, that's what it should look like. You go to EverQuest or even World of Warcraft, you see a forest, there's some trees, there you go. You know what that looks like. Now, if the graphics aren't even all that great, what I'm getting at is that if the graphics aren't all that great, your mind can fill in the blanks. Now, this is automatically done. This is done by the human brain, is that you will automatically try to fill in missing pieces. And game developers know this quite well, at least the good ones do, is that if you build a forest, and as long as, you know, the graphics aren't exactly the best, as long as it looks like a forest, your brain will take the leap and say, okay, that's a forest I'm looking at, or okay, that's a lake I'm looking at, or, you know, if you see something, you know, if you see something blue around green, you'll say to yourself, okay, that's a lake in the middle of a meadow. Okay, because how do you know that? Well, your brain was able to associate those common items with real world items. So you already kind of know what's going on in this world, and the graphics don't have to be that great, and you can recognize and relate to everything. Now you take science fiction MMOs. Science fiction MMOs, by nature, take place in the future or on some other galaxy or some place. So you might have these wacky space stations, or you might have these wacky planets with all this wacky technology. So what the heck are these things? Now, especially if you don't have that great graphics, you might look at this thing and say, okay, if I'm on a world and the ground is purple and I see something else that's gray, how am I going to know that the ground is actually purple and that gray stuff is actually a lake? I'm not. I mean, I have to actually go in there and say, oh, okay, I can't walk on this. I'm going inside of it. I guess this must be a water or a lake or something. But, oh, no, what is this? Is this acid? Is this killing me? I don't know what the heck's going on. Or you look at a space station, you see all these things, and you're trying to figure out, how do they work? Okay, how does this, you know, what is this technology going on? And also, if the graphics aren't that great, you're going to think, wow, this is supposed to be the 24th century. This thing looks like crap. So, again, it's much harder to lose yourself in a science fiction MMO. There's a lot less points of reference. It requires a lot more, you know, a lot more for you to be invested into this. So it's just very, very hard for these MMOs to take off. Now, obviously, these other science fiction games obviously succeed very well. And why is that? Well, because it's not an MMO. An MMO really is a social interaction experiment, if you will. It's almost like it's a big chat room with things to do. It's a chat room with killing monsters and characters and experience. And if you have, you know, if you have someone who's going to be dedicated to this chat room, this world, you really have to make sure that people can identify with it quickly and easily without having to work for it. If you have a science fiction MMO, people have to work for it. And there's going to be that hardcore set that will. They're going to sit there and they're going to love it. They're going to be invested in the world. They're going to be invested in seeing what's going on. But a vast majority of people will not. You know, they're there at the higher levels to just sort of have fun and fool around with people and, you know, go on adventures. They're not going to sit there and try to learn the language of the Gricklocks and the Micmocks or whatever, and to understand the tribal differences between these two factions that have been going over for the last 3,000 years for, you know, these, they have, you know, no basis of reference anywhere outside this game. So, you know, I can go on this all day, all night, but that's one of the main reasons. Those are probably the two main reasons these fail over and over again, science fiction MMOs, is that they have no points of references. They require a huge amount of commitment from players. It, you know, it requires a lot of technology, requires a lot of very, very good storytelling. And even if you're using a brand that already exists, like Star Wars, if you don't do that brand right, you get the opposite effect. Like Star Wars Everyone thought, oh, that's going to be a no-brainer. But if you do not pay homage to the Star Wars universe correctly, you get the exact opposite. You get people rebelling. People don't want to be part of it. And, oh, I forgot about the last part. Most important part. And this, I'm just going to mention this. People do not like to play monsters. I know you think this is crazy, but people like to play humanoids. Take World of Warcraft. By far, the most popular, the two most popular races that make up more than 50% of all the races in the game, there's eight races, are the humans and the night elves. Those two races are the most popular. And that's one of the main reasons they added blood elves. Let me tell you, I've talked to them about this. The people just do not like to play monsters. We'll take the orcs in World of Warcraft. The orcs are the second least played race, I believe, in World of Warcraft. Now, this is the main race. You know, there's the orcs and the humans. It might be second or third, but I think worldwide, it's the second least played. And they just, you know, people just don't like to play monsters. And if you have a science fiction world, you have humans, and then you have what, aliens? Again, you have monsters, okay? And people just don't like to play them. And a lot of these science fiction worlds, they have a huge number of people playing the aliens. Maybe you say, I mean, aliens, playing the humans, and only a very small percentage of people playing the aliens. So maybe they'll have the humans, and then they'll have three alien cultures. And you might have 75% of people playing aliens, and then the other three alien cultures are divided up about 25% of the regular playing population. And again, you can say, well, what about StarCraft, things like that? This is not the same. This is not a tactical strategy game where you're sitting there and you're only playing for a few hours at a time. This is a game where you are putting on an avatar, a persona inside a realm. Do you really want to be walking around with two heads for the next 2 years talking to people and have that represent you? Or would you have a very hot-looking human being represent you? Most people will go for the hot-looking human. So that's, again, that's another reason these science fiction MMOs do not do well. I will say I'm very, very interested to see how Auto Assault does, because Auto Assault is a science fiction MMO, hardcore science fiction, but it also is hardcore driving, and the graphics are so good. The actual three types of people, there's humans, there's mutants, and then there's these, like, cyberhumans. They're basically all humanoids. It's going to be pretty interesting to see what happens. But I remember even talking to those guys, and they said that the mutants aren't played as much as the humans or the humanoids. The mutants are probably the third of the three in popularity. And again, just to show you, people just don't like to play these monster types in MMOs. I think this Auto Assault actually will do pretty well because the driving combat element is just so well done, but I am definitely going to be interested to see that. Anyhow, thanks for all your questions. That was obviously a little too long. I think that's going to be the first and last time I actually had to do a 40-minute question and answer segment. I could probably do a whole show on these, and maybe I should just release these as a show. But if you do have questions, do send them to me. The audio questions I prefer, you can send them. There's a link on the site, feedback@gamingsteve.com. You can send it to me as a wave format. It's usually a little better. And keep them to about 20 to 30 seconds in length, and I will hopefully play it on the show.
Game and Steve's final thoughts.
So final thoughts for this week. Well, let's see. We're getting pretty close to the Xbox 360's launch. It's about a week away. And there were rumors floating around that Circuit City was actually going to start releasing the game and system and start selling it early on Friday. I just read that that was completely false. Is that, in fact, on Friday they're going to be selling pre-order bundles, but the game will still be released on Tuesday like everyone else. So don't jump out of the car to your local Circuit City just yet, because it's not coming out until Tuesday anyhow. And for those of you who didn't pre-order one, oof, best of luck to you. The one thing I would probably recommend, I've said this before in previous shows, is check out Costco or Price Club or BJ's. Believe it or not, those are actually pretty good places. I mean, they're crowded and they get a lot of foot traffic, but people do not think to go there right away to buy these systems. And more than once, I've told people, there was a couple of months ago, there was actually a big shortage of Xboxes for some reason, and they couldn't find them anywhere, and that's where they went, and sure enough, there they were. So, and that's, in fact, where I ordered mine from for the pre-order and got it. I'm going to get it no problem. So I think they're totally sold out if you check online. But if you're desperate to find an Xbox 360, go to places that other people might not think they would normally go. Obviously, Best Buy and Toys R Us and those type of places, EB, everyone's going to go there. But people, places like BJ's or your local electronics store, things like that, people might not think to go there right away. Other things. So real quick, I'm getting a lot of people that are writing me emails about the PSP and how I'm so down on it because it's not turning out to be a gaming platform as much as a multimedia platform. I just want to say something about that. I actually really like the PSP, I'll tell you. My big issue with the PSP is that it is not a gaming platform, or at least it's not going to be just a core gaming platform like I thought it was going to be. And it really upsets me when I go to EB Games or GameStop and I see aisles and aisles of movies and UMD movies for the PSP, and the PC aisle is 1/5 the size of the movie aisle. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, one of the main reasons is they can't sell back used PC games. They can't sell them back. In fact, GameStop and EB do no longer take PC titles and will not try to resell them. But movies and UMD movies, yeah, they can sell them. They make a mint off of those. They can sell these used titles and make tremendous profits on them. So they're going to be pushing them much harder. And the other thing is that it's very easy for Sony or any studio to take a movie they already have, throw it on UMD, and release it. So you're going to start seeing a huge amount of movies being released on UMD for the PSP. And, you know, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But where are the games? I keep waiting for the games to come out, and that's what I bought it for. You know, if I want a portable movie device, I can get a portable DVD player, which, you know, actually I think it does a better job. It's only a little bit bigger. The screen's a lot bigger, a lot crisper, and I already have DVDs. I don't have to go out and spend another $20-$30 on these UMDs, which only work in a PSP. So that's my issue with the PSP. You know, the name of the show is Gaming Steve. It is talking about gaming, and, you know, it's not Video Steve or Multimedia Steve. It's Gaming Steve. So I'm really looking at the PSP as a game device. And if this thing starts morphing into something else, like a portable video recorder, you're not going to see games being developed, you know, AAA titles being released and developed on this as much as you might have hoped. I mean, luckily, Grand Theft Auto was released on this, and from what I can tell, is selling fantastically. In fact, I can't even find it. I remember when it came out a few weeks ago, there was just mountains of these things, and I went to 2 Best Buys this weekend, and they're gone. They're just totally gone, and even my local EB was almost sold out of them. So obviously, you know, a AAA title like that will really help move the PSP back into the direction of a gaming machine. But, you know, that's what I'm excited about, is the PSP as a gaming platform, not as a portable movie platform. So just a little clarity on that one. I don't want people to think that I'm anti-PSP. I'm not anti-PSP. I'm pro-gaming, and anything that has games on it, I am interested in. So anyhow, that's pretty much it. Make sure you guys check back later in the week, and I will have the second part, or the rest of the show, as I would say, and so you guys don't have to download these things and it takes up 100 megs on your poor little iPod. So anyhow, I will talk to you guys later in the week. Enjoy your gaming. See ya.
You've been listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, keep exploding those barrels.